Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for May 31st, another exciting show. Welcome, Tim.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, and Catherine's on the second half of her big European vacation, and once again, we have another guest host, and I tried to get us somebody else that's very informed, just like Del Cardwell was last week. Miss Anastasia Offa joins us, and let me give you a little background before I bring her on. She's the owner and founder of the Offa firm, and they do political consulting, staffing, a lot of fundraising, just everything for candidates, Democratic candidates, and they work all over the country, but she's worked a lot of races in the South, probably worked races or had addresses in Tennessee, Mississippi, and Florida in the past, say, 2 years. Offa, welcome.
Well, thank you for that warm introduction, Dave, and glad to be on with you and Tim today.
Yes, yes, and you'll tell us more about different things throughout the hour. I tell you what, we're going to get into some of your real background areas in just a minute, but since it's such a burning issue nationally, and Newt Gingrich put a southern tilt on it, Sonia Sotomayor, she was nominated to the Supreme Court, and a lot of Republicans came on and attacked her, but really after Newt Gingrich, a former Georgia congressman, joined in the attacks, calling her a racist, and I think Rush Limbaugh may have said a reverse racist. Being our guest, Offa, we'll let you have the first crack at this issue. What you think?
Well, look, I think it's amazing, and I think it's a historical time when we can see a person from a single-parent home, you know, get seated on the Supreme Court justice, and I think President Obama is doing the right thing. Unity. I mean, look, no matter if it's a Democrat who like the Democrat, you know, have some people on the other side or on the same side who just don't feel like it's the right appointment. And so, look, some of the Republicans are upset. I think some Democrats might even be upset. I think it's okay. And at the end of the day, if we're able to get her confirmed, I think it's a wonderful appointment. I salute President Obama for looking deep, when he's putting people on the Supreme Court justice, people who can really relate to other people who are making decisions as humans. I think it's important. And I'm looking forward to kind of seeing how the whole thing plays out.
Yes. Tim, your thoughts on it?
Well, our good buddy old Newt, he takes the statement out of context and he runs with it. Now, he and Rush Limbaugh are pretty much reduced to having a war of words with senators in their own party over this. Just this morning, Jeff Sessions, now he's not the most liberal fellow in the world, he said on Meet the Press that they should stop this. The Republicans had best be very careful with this sort of thing, lest it blow up in their faces.
Yeah, I tell you, if you want to hear a lot of extended thoughts, do listen to Game On, my national show. We just happened to hit it the night that this appointment was made that day, and Stephen Turkemeyer, our attorney, came on to the show, and he really gave a lot of legal perspective on this too. But I said then, and I'll reiterate it now, I think it's very problematic for the Republicans to stand against any nominee, irregardless of their background. But given the fact that this is a historical, appointment, and then the fact that, they could be alienating Hispanic voters for years to come, I think it makes it all the more tricky. Offa, since you're in Florida, and that's obviously a key area for Hispanic voting, what do you see as the pitfalls and perils of this for Republicans? Or Tim, what do you see as the pitfalls?
Well, obviously, they don't want to make it look like they're piling on for no reason. And like I've already said, and like some Republican senators have said, David, some guys that are not in elected office setting up there that are going to have to vote on this are the ones that are running their mouths the most. Now, Limbaugh yapped again Friday. I'm sure you saw tape of it. And he's going to do it again, and you're probably going to be talking about this on Game On Tuesday because he's not going to shut up. I think the Republican Senate's problem is Limbaugh and Gingrich and guys like that they cannot control, that they cannot call in the caucus room and say, okay, cool it. Don't you think that?
Oh, yes. Appa, I think we lost your connection. We brought you back. I was just asking you, being that you're in Florida where Hispanic voting strength is stronger than the average state in America, do you think this poses potential pitfalls that are unique in long-term gains for the Republicans in Hispanic voting?
But I think it was smart of President Obama to look at someone from a Hispanic background. I think more than anything else, he looked at look at the current appointee because she's qualified and because she's going to have the right kind of judgment on the Supreme Court. I think here in Florida, it's important. I think people are excited and they feel proud of a historical victory that we have the opportunity to have here. But at the end of the day, I believe in the democratic process. I believe in the process, and I think that you're going to have Republicans, and I wouldn't even be surprised if we had a few Democrats that had some questions about her appointment. These are important appointments, and President Obama has a monumental task here of putting the right people in place. And I think that the Hispanic voting bloc here in Florida is excited and wants to see her appointed, and I think they're all looking forward to that. But I don't know just how much noise people are making over it. I think we're still kind of just sitting back and watching to see how it all plays out, especially in the Hispanic community. They're looking forward to it and feeling optimistic about the opportunity.
Yeah, I know they did a flash poll the day of the appointment, and it showed that Hispanic voters were very enthused by this because I guess this will be one of the highest-ranking Hispanic people in American history. So it was automatically something. And it was, if you've seen from 2004 to 2008, Hispanic voting had gone more Democratic. And if the Republicans basically have Hispanic voters do anything close to what African-American voters do, I mean, there's just no way to put together a winning coalition in the foreseeable future.
I think all over the country what we're really seeing is more Hispanics running, more Hispanics raising serious dollars for office. I mean, in Florida, in South Florida, this past election cycle, what you saw was three Hispanics running for office who put up real strong contests against prominent Republicans who were sitting in the congressional seats of 18, 25, and 26. I mean, Raul Martinez, Joe Garcia, and Annette Tadeo ran what I think were strong campaigns and who really kind of showed people in other parts of the country that Democrats could begin to win some of these what were known as red seats. And I think in all ranks of office, you're seeing more Hispanics running. You're seeing that enthuse the Hispanic base of voters. I think it's encouraging, and I think that President Obama's got a real vision and kind of looking ahead. And at the end of the day, what we really want in the Supreme Court are people who are qualified, who are competent, who are going to really have fair judgment. And I think this appointee does that.
Yes, and you mentioned Annette Tadeo, and if I'm not mistaken, she's Cuban American, and that's always been seen as a loyal Republican Hispanic voting bloc, but then her running, and I'm sure her getting a bigger share of the Cuban vote, was something to cause Republicans pause in South Florida.
Well, Annette Tadeo was actually, she was of those three Hispanics who are running in what were kind of called the Cuban seats here in South Florida. Joe Garcia was a Cuban running against a Cuban. Raul Martinez was a Cuban running against a Cuban. But Annette Tadeo is Colombian-born. And there are huge segments of South Americans who are here in South Florida. And so Annette Tadeo really did. I mean, she raised more than $1 million, put up a very, very strong campaign, and was able to enthuse not just parts of the Cuban base, who had historically voted more Republican, but really activating a lot of the South American base, the Colombians, the Venezuelans, and the Ecuadorians and some other groups. So I think more than anything, historically, Hispanics, Cuban Hispanics or Cuban Americans who had come here felt like they had to vote Republican, but now are kind of looking a little deeper into what the messages amongst the parties are, and I think more voting their own interests and less what their parents have been voting in the past. So it's encouraging.
Yes, and see, that's when we have your own as the expert of Florida in particular. See, I usually, Tim's fact-checking me. I got you two now, and that's okay because we want to bring the right facts to the folks.
So you are too kind. You are too kind.
Well, let's go ahead and really bring it into Florida, and we usually go top-down on these things, and it seems like the Senate race is the key race that people are focusing on in Florida. And by the way, Tim, keep giving me questions. We're going to turn you from guest host into guest for a moment since you're the expert on this. But tell us about that Senate race, what you know about it so far.
Well, I tell you, it's red hot right now. And this weekend here in South Florida, we had all Democrats from across the state come into the Fountain Blue Hotel. The Florida Democratic Party did a wonderful job of bringing Democrats from all across the state. And so you saw Alex Sink, who's just put her hat in the race for governor. You saw Kendrick Meek there. He made a personal appearance, and he had his people there. I mean, he looked really strong. You know, he's raised over $2 million. He's running a great campaign. And you see a lot of activity from some of the Republican candidates in the race, but really strong showing from top ticket Democrats. And I believe that Kendrick Meek did a great job as a congressman, has a good strong base here in South Florida, and is going to be able to raise the dollars necessary to make himself a viable candidate statewide.
Yes, and I guess, and Charlie Crist, he announced saying that he would run for Senate instead of governor, and he talked about how there was more that could be done for Florida in Washington than Tallahassee, which really doesn't usually fit with the Republicans' message. But then there's a lot of conservative Republicans that are angry at him, and they have Marco Rubio that's running against him. What are the chances that Rubio could knock off Crist in a Republican primary if it goes conservative enough?
Look, I think I would be surprised, but and what we've seen over the last couple cycles, especially in Florida, I mean, Obama took Florida. There just isn't anything that can happen. When you energize a Democratic base like the one that we have kind of hiding in the caves here in Florida, anything is possible. And I think Mr. Crist has a lot of work to do. I think, you know, we really are kind of in the midst of a change election. I think if Kendrick is able to get that Democratic Obama base energized, he'll do well, and that will help in the long run. But I think Rubio and Crist, I think it can be a fight. It really kind of depends on how much of the vote, especially the Hispanic vote, that he can bring out, Rubio, meaning statewide, and kind of what Crist does to energize some of his more right-wing Republican base. So I think it's going to be an interesting race, and I just can't call it. I think really it's going to depend on, we know Crist can raise the dollars. What is Rubio going to be able to do? He's never kind of ran at that capacity. I think it's something to watch, something that can really kind of turn out to be interesting. But, again, looking for the Democrats to kind of have the strongest showing there, and a lot of ground game, a lot of groundwork. I've seen a lot of people on the ground with Kendrick Meek signs. I think that's, a good sign, because he's going to have to, in addition to raising dollars, he's going to have to energize people statewide to get out to vote and kind of get active. So just interesting all across the board on the top of the ticket in Florida.
Yeah, Tim, jump in here and follow up with me.
Yeah, let me ask you one question about this Senate race. I'm looking at the Mason-Dixon poll, which is the latest one out of the Florida Senate race. And over on the Democratic side, Meek is enjoying about a 10-point lead, but the big story is the undecideds are listed at 58%.
Mm-hmm.
Why so high on the Democratic side?
Well, I think the first point is that we are so far out from the election. I mean, we're talking about November of 2010. So I think what's encouraging is the base that Kendrick Meek does have right now, I think, really shows and speaks to the kind of campaign that he's been running and what we can kind of see from him. If we can get to a 30%, less than 30% undecided 6 months out, I think we're doing the right thing. I think the voters are the ones who are kind of tuned in or paying attention to who their candidates are, and a lot of voters are just not tuned in. So that's really encouraging to me, I think, and positive news for Kendrick Meek, who's obviously done some work to retain some kind of support there so early on.
And over on the Republican side, we see the undecideds at, I don't know, about half of that. Is that because of the name recognition of Governor Crist or what?
I certainly think it has a lot to do with name recognition. I also think that especially in North Florida and Central Florida, the Republican Party has done a good job of continuously engaging their base. And so I think Republicans are just kind of more tuned into what's going on there. But name recognition is definitely a factor, especially when you're polling early on. When you see candidates kind of jumping out ahead, a lot of that has to do with name recognition. And so once dollars begin to get spent and candidates start to become defined by their opponents and by themselves, you get to see a lot of the undecided break in. You also kind of find that support can either get stronger or slip.
Okay, thank you. David.
Oh, yes. Well, I guess kind of going over now to the governor's race, I know Alex Sink is one of the leading candidates, and she's chief financial officer, which I was looking on Politics One. That puts her as the fourth highest state elected official under lieutenant governor, under, of course, governor and attorney general in their listings. Why do you think she's such a powerful figure in the Democratic Party?
I think Alex Sink has done a fantastic job, first of all, as chief fiscal officer of the state, keeping in contact with the voters and just doing a good job being open and accountable in office. Look, she's going to be able to enjoy a lot of support from the DGA and, of course, from Emily's List, who she's in the past have had support from. Alex Sink is a fierce fundraiser, and so she's going to raise some real dollars. She understands how to energize her base statewide. She's been able to do so and win elections in the past. So I think she's a serious candidate, and I think her jumping in the governor's race really kind of turns the heat up there. And Florida, I think, is really going to be an important state to kind of watch over the next 17 months.
Yes, and she's the only big-name Democrat in the race, but then there's two Republicans, and really they seem kind of like the B-list of the announcements. You have Bill Henley, who's listed as a anti-gay activist, and he was a candidate in 2004 and 2008. He's never won office. And then Bill McCollum, and if there's ever a political retread, this guy just needs to run every time. He finally won for attorney general, so I guess that kind of pumped him back up. It's kind of like a video game where the little life meter goes down and he finally did something to recover a little bit.
Yeah.
What is everybody making of the Republican part of this field?
Well, I think that, especially here in Florida, they call it a swing state for a reason. And if these Republicans, especially, you know, Mr. McCollum, he's got the name recognition. People know who he is. And, of course, we've had some monumental faux pas in the past. But really, we want to look at the Republican Party here in Florida with a close eye and kind of see exactly how they get to work energizing their base. There's nothing you can't do. Let's take a look at Mississippi and Kentucky and states like that. I mean, you get a rebel flag issue on a ballot, and Republicans are flying out of their homes to get to the vote. So we want to just make sure that, and I really kind of encourage Democrats at the top of the ticket and it's from the national party to pay attention to this, to just do what we can over the next 17 months to really keep our base active, because Republicans are smart, they run smart races, and they do them from the ground up. I think Obama won in a place like Florida because he did his work on the ground, and I think it's going to be important for Democrats, no matter what part of the ticket they're running on, to really kind of get out there early and keep their voters energized and to make sure that people understand that it's time to vote, because Republicans will vote in Florida.
Yeah. Tim, any more questions on the governor's race or even?
Yeah, got a couple of them, actually. I'm again looking at the Mason-Dixon poll, and they show McCollum 40%, Alex Sink 34%, 26% undecided. Do those numbers not indicate that this race is fluid and could really go either way right now?
I think you're right on it there, Tim. Definitely a fluid race, a race where there's going to be a lot of money at work, which makes it kind of even more more exciting to watch because the numbers will move. And I think what you're kind of also seeing there is you're seeing some kind of party line towing. You're seeing where Democrats fall and where Republicans fall. And I think a lot of those undecided voters are going to be coming from the central and southern part of the state, where they really don't have the same level of familiarity with these two candidates that you have in North Florida, and because of some of the support that these candidates enjoy on the west coast of Florida. So I think it does show we have a fluid race. I think it also shows some strength in terms of name recognition. And so I think that's going to be another race that Florida is going to surprise folks with.
And the other question I got is I guess, a hard one to nail down, but I'm going to try it anyway. Is the Florida voter the type of voter that would split their vote to the extent that the same voter would vote for both Charlie Crist and Alex Sink?
That really is a tough one, and I think that Florida voters are smart and educated. I think the Democrats that come out are going to vote straight ticket Democrat. And frankly, I think either party, I think that's really their task. They need to make sure that these Democrats come out and vote straight ticket, especially some of the candidates that are running kind of, you know, for Congress and in some of the smaller offices, the more local offices, I should say. They're really going to be counting on the people at the top of the ticket to spend dollars to make sure that people know to kind of vote straight party tickets. I think that's going to be important in this election for either Democrats or Republicans to make sure that they do that. Because if people start splitting the ticket, I think you're going to have some problems here. So will a Florida voter do that? I don't know if there's anything, Tim, that a Florida voter won't do. But I do know that the parties have to get to work to make sure that people vote straight ticket. Otherwise, we may have some real, some devastating things happen.
All right, thanks. David?
Yes, now I was reading a book, How Barack Obama Won, and when it got to the chapter about Florida, it called it one of the most complex state, or maybe the most complex state in the nation to work as a political consultant. Tell us, what's the winning formula for a Democrat, and then what are the pitfalls for a Democratic candidate in Florida, and kind of really use geography?
Well, I don't claim to be any expert on this particular subject. I think we're all kind of, as operatives, still making sure we get to work to figure out what the voters are looking for. And I think it's kind of an ongoing and an ever-changing need. But I definitely know that the same things that we have to do in every part of the state, we have to do every part of the country, I should say, we have to do in Florida. The first thing is that candidates have to be serious. They need to run serious races. They need to raise real dollars. They need to get up on TV. In Florida, you have some of the most expensive media markets that you're going to find anywhere in the country. So the candidates here really are going to have to be hard at raising real dollars, getting up on TV, communicating a clear, consistent message. And just like anywhere else in the country, especially in Florida, folks have got to pound the ground. They need to have grassroots operations. They need to have people knocking at doors. They need to be IDing who their supporters are and keeping in contact with those voters through mail and other forms of communication. Early on, and just really kind of keeping those folks close to their chest. I think here in Florida, more than anything else, there's always something happening, and voters are a little more tuned out than they can be in other parts of the country. So I think what Obama did was he raised the money, he spent the dollars to communicate a clear, consistent message, and really kind of tuned into what the people wanted. And I think that any candidate can kind of look to the president to see what he did in terms of how hard he worked on the ground to knock every door and call every voter, and realize that that is the way you win a race, no matter what level of office you're running at and no matter where you are.
Yeah, because I do know that I guess the north part of the state along the panhandle is more conservative.
Mm-hmm.
There are pockets of conservatism throughout the lower portion of the state, but it's more Democratic around Miami and than, say, it would be around Jacksonville. Is that
mm-hmm.
Which brings up a question I'd like to throw out there right now. What color is Florida? Is it blue, red, or purple?
It's purple. Florida, I think, in my opinion, Florida is a purple state, and I think once in a while it's even a little more red than it can be blue. And the reason I say that is just because we have a history here in Florida of being able to get the Republican base energized very quickly. I think President Obama has definitely set some new highs for the state. Democrats have an existing base that they can just continue to kind of energize as we move into the new election cycle here. And I think one of the most interesting things about Florida as a state and in terms of politics is just how fluid this place is. And you have so many people that are qualified and running for office. I'm just really excited and looking forward to a very, very active election cycle here.
Yeah, I'm for some reason I'm visualizing tie-dye, I guess, with the Florida yellow sometimes and red, blue,
right,
and purple all mixed in. Well, we're going to come back to you on some of those other states. You know, we're going to let you catch your breath a little bit and come back to a Georgia topic that made a lot of news in our state, and that was Nathan Deal. He's run for he's decided to move from Congress and run for the governorship of Georgia. No one's been real excited about his campaign other than some congressmen. He did get the endorsement of a lot of congressmen in the past 10 days. But it hasn't been like a lot of buzz around his campaign, if you will. But he seemed to make a move that seemed to have a little bit of ulterior motives. This week he reintroduced a bill that talking about, you know, not making being born in the U.S. a citizenship of birthright. Pretty controversial piece of legislation that doesn't affect Georgia any more than it would anywhere else in the United States, given that he needs to have more of an in-state focus. Tim, what's your thoughts on this?
Okay, we have the latest incarnation of the Birthright Citizenship Act of 2009. You mentioned he reintroduced it. This is actually the third time this has been introduced. I don't even believe it's made it to the floor for a vote yet. I don't think there's any danger of passage this time. The cute thing about all this, the curious thing, is Mr. Deal says he just doesn't have any idea how this story made headlines. Oh, really? you know, I'm scratching my head when he even bothers to say something like that. Well, look, I don't believe he'd be doing this if Hispanics voted Republican. Because, like I've already said, this bill's not going anywhere. It's the third time he's reintroduced it. He knows it's not going anywhere. What he's doing is what you've already alluded to, David. He's trying to make a name for himself. He's trying to excite the base. He's trying to be a player in the game because coming out of the gate, his candidacy has been, to put it charitably, flat. Would that be a good way to put it?
Yeah, I would definitely think it doesn't have the buzz that the Ox video that Karen Handel put out had.
No.
Appa, to give you a little background, Nathan Deal has two cities in his district, Gainesville, Georgia, and Dalton, Georgia, which have, I believe, the first and second highest Hispanic population in the state by percentage, and yet he still introduces bills like this, which shows that he's not trying to represent all his people.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I think that these are the kind of tactics that we see over and over from some of the Republican Party members. And I really do believe that that there's got to be some utility in it for him. I don't know all the local politics there, but when you begin to kind of do things where you are alienating and isolating voters, you're kind of treading a very dangerous line there. So I'm kind of interested to kind of find out from you all how you feel that's really going to have an impact on the vote, and what do you think his kind of strategy is behind that kind of move?
Well, that's simple. The 9th district where Nathan Deal is from on a map goes nearly across the top portion of Georgia and kind of curves around down toward the Gainesville and Lake Lanier area. And it was, I believe, the 4th best performing county in the whole United States for John McCain. That's how conservative this area is. Those are the voters that Nathan Deal needs to tap into if he has any chance at all of becoming the next governor of Georgia. And that's what this was all really about, don't you think, David?
Oh, yes. And I guess kind of putting it back into that Florida, you know, prism for you, this is not the, there's, even though there's a lot of Hispanic voters, this is not Miami or Ybor City where you have Hispanic roots. These are folks that are very new to the district and just don't have a, you know, history of voting. So I guess he feels he doesn't have to worry about these folks, and he can use them as, you know, political pawns to then, you know, incite the more angry white elements of his district, and then of course the GOP base in Georgia, because he does have other, the Secretary of State of Georgia, she's running. She put out a video at their convention that made a lot of headlines. John Oxendine, the insurance commissioner, is backed by a lot of the insurance industry, and those are considered the two front runners. So this guy jumps in with the backing of a lot of congressmen, but he's trying to make his way, and there's also other candidates in this race. So it's just hard. It's one of those multi-candidate races where it's hard to break out. And really the Democratic side in Georgia is much the same way, because you've got the attorney general running. You've got the former head of the National Guard of Georgia running, who's also been the labor commissioner. You have the minority leader of the party running. And then the former governor, we're hearing rumors again that he may jump back into either this, or more people are talking about that Senate race.
And isn't he supposed to make some sort of announcement tomorrow?
Everybody talks about June 1st. That's the magic date for not only Roy Barnes, but a lot of places around the country, different candidates. But then, you know, I heard more and more buzz today, instead of him running for governor again, running for Senate, because I guess he's hearing the same things we're hearing, that Johnny Isaacson is one of the most vulnerable Republicans that nobody's talking about.
And there's nobody else in that race either.
No, it's not. Appa, we don't know if you've heard much about Roy Barnes and the two races or his, you know, his name around the country. Any thoughts on Roy Barnes?
I really have not heard a lot. I just want to kind of backtrack here and just think. Let's throw a word of caution to the wind here, and let's just think about the concept of a base that was not historically energized, that just elected the first African-American president. I think, you know, when political candidates want to kind of play dangerous games of isolating certain ethnic bases, I think they're kind of treading a thin line there, and walking on some ice, I should say, because you really get into a situation where people who have not historically voted can easily get registered. There's plenty of time for them to get registered to vote, to get active and get out to the polls. And so it would be interesting to kind of see what kind of who is at work, making sure that these folks know about what this candidate is saying and how that impacts them. And he can energize his base, and there may be other folks that are able to use some of his missteps to energize a different base that would hurt him. So that's kind of interesting to me.
Yeah, we've talked about one of the legacies could be that he does more to energize Hispanic voting in Georgia than any other politician in a negative way. I mean, it's kind of, you know, like wrestling. Sometimes they buy the tickets to cheer for the guy, and sometimes they buy the tickets to cheer against the guy.
The second.
So, but speaking of villains, Tim, it's a little early, but it's halfway point in the show, and this is just too good a topic not to give some discussion to. Your outrage of the week, you're bringing it out for the first time in a few weeks. Go ahead and give it to us.
Sure. Let's talk for a bit about the religious wrong. Now, I call them that because, frankly, they never seem to do anything that is remotely right. Every time you turn around, this bunch looks like something straight out of the Byzantine Empire. When are these people going to join us in the 21st century? On May 21st, Liberty University announced that the school was withdrawing its sanctioning of its Student Democratic Club. This club formed in the fall of last year and announced that they would support the Democratic Party and its principles, and they also supported Barack Obama for president. So that club didn't get to last for long, did it? Now, why did Liberty University do this? Well, according to Mark Hine, Vice President of Student Affairs, the club's parent organization, the Democratic Party, and I'm going to quote here, stands against the moral principles held by the school, and therefore the club no longer can be sanctioned. And Maria Childers, the staff advisor to this club, added to that, and I quote again, the school has issues with the Democratic Party platform. Did they say the party platform? Oh, good grief. The party platform in both parties is something that is done on paper to mollify different groups in the base, and then nobody pays any attention to it during election time, including the candidates. You know what else Mark Hines said that I think was telling? And I'm going to quote again. He said, you can't be a Democrat and be a Christian and be a university representative. According to who? Well, you know what? I'll tell you who. That would be Thomas Road Baptist Church and Jerry Falwell Jr. And what is Mr. Falwell's idea of a solution to this problem? Well, he proposed that the group adopt a national organization called Democrats for Life as its parent organization. The club would essentially become a single-issue group then and would not be allowed to endorse any pro-choice candidates, which means most Democratic candidates for office. Now, get this. You know where Falwell got his advice for this little idea? Bob McDonnell. That's right, the same guy who is the GOP nominee for governor of Virginia. So... I believe we have a non-starter here on settling this thing. You know, here's the problem with the whole mess at Liberty University. They are fundamentalists. They teach their own version of the truth. They teach intolerance of any beliefs other than their own, including political. And they teach condemnation and suppression of those who disagree with them. And all the while, they trumpet their self-righteousness, much like the biblical Pharisees. And they can sugarcoat this thing all they want to. But the truth is, the Thomas Road Baptist Church, Liberty University, and the Lynchburg area are all conservative Republican territory. It's not really about platforms or abortion or same-sex marriage or any of that other stuff. They know that every one of these students in this Democratic club is pro-life and favors traditional marriage, every last one of them. But what they also know is that all of these students are Democrats, and they just don't want Democrats to be there because they are right-wing Republicans. There are 30 students, 30 members of this club, out of a student campus population of 11,500 people. These 30 members have now been reduced to the level of second-class citizens on this campus. Oh, they can still be Democrats. Nobody can stop them from doing that. They just can't be the Liberty University Democratic Club any longer. 30 kids in a school of what is supposed to be higher learning. Oh, my goodness. Are we ever going to get by stuff like this? Does Falwell think this is going to score him some political points with the average voter? Or is the conservative wing of the GOP so gone, so out there, that there's simply no reason left in it? You see, we Democrats believe that you can disagree with some things that other Democrats or even the National Party believes and still support Democrats for public office. Now, Falwell knows that, but he just wants to win. He doesn't want to be tolerant. He doesn't want other viewpoints at liberty. Sort of sounds like his father, doesn't he, David?
Tim, I was just thinking he's outdone his father. I remember the Teletubby incident. Wasn't there a Barney incident maybe with Reverend Falwell? I think this actually maybe surpasses it because it is such an attack on the First Amendment.
His father even went off after the Smurfs, if you recall.
The Smurfs, I mean, but yeah, I mean, yeah. This is just, but you know, I mean, this is obviously, you hear a lot of, you know, people of religion that talk about, oh, China, you can't have a Bible. How egregious is that? There's no freedom of assembly, all these things. Isn't that the very thing they're banning on their campus? You know, how hypocritical.
And it, you know, it's a little political club. I mean, what would be the harm? I'm going to tell you something else, too. They say, well, we're a private university. I'll tell you what, in the form of student aid, they get a lot of public money. That's my tax money going up there. If they want to do this nonsense, let them get private financing, and then I won't never complain at all. How about that?
I think what's kind of interesting about this here is that I heard the president, the young president of the Democratic Club there at Liberty University on NPR, and what he was discussing was why the club was important and how having this right taken away from them or suspended as it is currently, they're unable to organize, they're unable to put together flyers, do fundraisers on campus. So in other words, kind of their activity arm, their outreach arm has been severed. I think when you look at a story like this, I can definitely hear what you're saying, Tim. And if in fact there is some public financing going on, I think that we definitely have a voice in this. I do believe as a Democrat, however, that it's important for there to be some kind of, and I call it isolation just to kind of rouse everybody's feathers here amongst groups. I think if there was a Democratic group that did not want to have people in it, that did not believe that it was okay to be pro-life, for example, I would not want to have people who are pro-life sitting in a campaign core class, Emily's List campaign core class next to me. I think it's important that groups have some some kind of solidity in their message and in their practices. What I do think is wrong, however, is that they're trying to reduce this Democratic group to a one-issue group. I think Democrats believe in a lot of things. I'd like to believe that there are Democrats somewhere in the world who are pro-life. I think being a Democrat has become less about issue, more about bread and butter. People all across the country, no matter what state you're in, voted for Obama because they were ready for someone who understood that it was time for us to get more jobs, get health care, get out of the war in Iraq. And I don't know if party is mattering as much as it used to. And so I'd like to say shame on Liberty University for trying to reduce this group down to a one-issue voice, and a big hands up for you, Tim, for kind of bringing this out here and hanging that ring around his neck.
Well, let me throw this question out there to you, David. You mentioned, you know, his father and some of the shenanigans he pulled, and he was famous for those. Reverend Falwell was. But do you think he would have handled this situation the same way or differently?
Given that he was on crossfire so much, I don't know that maybe he was as afraid of open political dialogue. I mean, he might have wanted the right to go after the Teletubbies, but then not. Yeah. I mean, because he could have done this a long time ago. You have to think that in the history of Liberty University, that sometimes somebody's, you know, brought up a Democratic club at different times.
Well, the reason I ask that is Falwell Sr. actually had Ted Kennedy come there to speak.
That, yeah.
This bunch now wouldn't do it.
That's the kind of thing. You, great fact. Tim, the scariest thing I think you said was 11,000 students on that campus, what's basically a Bob Jones with a football team.
Right.
11,000 people pay tuition to go there. My word.
Right.
You know, because I know that's one of the ones where they check, that's the kind of school where they check your CD collection to see what kind of music you have. I mean, it's a very restrictive environment. I mean, more restrictive than most people's homes are with their own parents at a younger age than that. I mean, it's pretty crazy.
Is this a healthy environment for a college student?
I kind of have a feeling that it's the kind of thing where if you are trying to give free exchange of ideas in a class, you'd be squelched. I tell you what, Ms. Childers, and what an apropos name for a Democratic advisor, I'm sure Travis and Buddy would both be proud. But those are two of our favorite guests in the past, the Childers, that were not related but both good Democrats. But you have to think that her days are numbered in whatever position. I mean, she may be the lowest-end bookkeeper. She may be the lady that's the janitor, but you got to think her days are numbered at Liberty University for having the courage to be their advisor.
Right.
And that's a sad state of affairs. And then I guess the final thing on this, because then it relates to another, you know, big issue, the most exciting race in the South right now, the Virginia governor's race, Bob O'Connell getting involved in this race, what kind of damage can that do to him? And when he was in a position, which right now he was the leader, but he's made this a by getting involved, made it a campaign issue. And Terry McAuliffe, his most likely opponent, has befriended the Liberty University Democrats.
Well,
this thing into the arena in the governor's race.
Well, all three of us have worked in campaigns and worked with candidates. And if I'm one of Bob McDonald's age, I'm jumping up and down and screaming right there. That was a mistake. He shouldn't have gotten involved.
Alpha, what kind of damage you think could be done in that race by him getting involved?
I just don't know enough to talk about that race. So I don't want to make a comment. I guess the question I would ask you guys again is what kind of fundraising can he do? What kind of campaign do you feel like he can build? And does he have an existing base that you think can be a threat in this race?
Well, McDonald, I mean, he was the leading candidate. He led Terry McAuliffe, Craig Deeds, and Brian Moran, all three Democrats, and they did have a contested primary. So he was set up really nicely. But now Terry McAuliffe has just started to gain so much more momentum. And you, as a Democratic fundraiser, you are aware of and probably in awe at times of Terry McAuliffe's fundraising prowess.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, he's just a monster. He's a beast, and I know some folks that have raised money for him, and they don't play any games. He just is really committed to it. I think anyone running against him has got to be a little insane. But look, there are so many races up and down the ticket there in Georgia. I have some friends that are raising money for state rep candidates, state senate candidates. And I just think that at the end of the day, there's going to be some very interesting things happening in throughout the state, especially in Georgia. And that race is definitely one to watch with the star power that McCullough has. I think that in itself is just makes that race exciting.
Yeah, well, that's just it. McDonald, all he had to do was sit there and be quiet. They even cleared the field for him on the Republican side. He doesn't have a contested primary. He could sit back and watch the Democrats go after each other with chainsaws and then face a bloodied up victor in November. And why he had to jump into this, I just do not know. Again, I have to say that was a mistake, right?
Oh, bad play. Well, Appa, you just got finished working in Mississippi for the second time in inside of 2 years. Tell us about Mississippi politics and what the lay of the land is. And obviously it had one of its most democratic things happen, a little bit of progress in the presidential race.
Yeah, I think, look, I just finished up working for a candidate who ran for mayor of Jackson, Marshawn Chrysler, who was dynamic and amazing, a 40-year-old who had 21 years of military experience, 17 years of law enforcement experience, and who was sitting in city council for 8 years, kind of watching some of what was happening there and shaking his head and saying, no, we need a new direction and a better direction, and threw his hat in the race. Now, get this, Jackson, Mississippi, probably one of the most important races of this past cycle in the state of Mississippi, the mayor of Jackson, at the capital city of the state of Mississippi, and we had someone, Harvey Johnson, who was the mayor for 8 years. For 2 terms, and 4 years ago, the voters of Jackson, Mississippi voted him out by 60%. They voted in a gentleman named Frank Melton, who just passed away about 10 days before the May 19th runoff. And Mayor Melton was under federal indictment and kind of facing some pretty serious health conditions. Long story short, 4 years ago, they voted Harvey Johnson up by 60%. And this year, in Jackson, Mississippi, voted against change, against an experienced fresh face, and for the mayor that they'd voted out 4 years previous by 60%. They voted him back in. So, look, I think Mississippi is really one of these states that is just it's just fist fighting against change. And to have something happen in what is a 74% Democratic area like Jackson, Mississippi, more like 85%, 90% Democratic, and 74-75% African American, you find voters in the African American communities in Mississippi that are just still not ready for change. It's a little bit more secure. I think in Mississippi you're going to see some more exciting things. You have the governor's race coming up. In 07, the cycle was a little more slow with John Arthur Eaves kind of running at the top of the ticket and not being able to kind of rouse the kind of support that the Democrats needed to have any real serious victory statewide there. But I think that the other thing that's interesting about Mississippi right now is in places that are neighboring the capital city like Madison, Madison County and Rankin County, you saw some change happening, and you saw the mayor of Madison staying in there again. They call the Brick Queen. She's kind of an amazing woman. But to summarize all this, I have to say that Mississippi is a state that I keep a close eye on. They're so in need of change. Did not go as a state for Obama. It's still kind of sitting on the brink of their change, and an important place to keep our eye on. Because I think they're just kind of just sitting on the edge of it. And I guess what you're hearing from me is just a little bit of a personal plea here. I want to see Mississippi do some great things for Democrats. There's some great Democratic candidates that are going to be running for state Senate and some great candidates up for Congress this year. So I think Mississippi is one of those places where I'm going to keep my heartstrings attached.
Yes. I mean, obviously, Travis Childers, which you mentioned earlier, he won that seat in North Mississippi, which gave them one more congressional seat. So that was a gain. I mean, it's just going to be a state where gains are going to have to go slow, because I've heard consultants tell me that worked in Mississippi, and not yourself, but people, I guess, were prior, said that, you know, Mississippi is a state where race is almost at the forefront of so many issues, particularly for white voters. I mean, I heard one time they voted against kindergarten, and a lot of it was racially motivated. I mean, and this was in the 90s they were doing this, not, you know, not 30 and 40 years ago. So is that something they're slowly working through, or –
Look, I agree with you, Dave. I think that Mississippi continues to be one of those states where race is more important than party, and more important than anything in a lot of cases. And every time you're communicating a message as an operative or as a campaign manager there in Mississippi, you have to be looking at how that message is racially sensitive, and at the same time of kind of being strong amongst your base. If you're white, you're black. You know, your white base. If you're black, you're base, and being a black candidate who's not too white, not taking too much white money, and how many ministers are standing with you. I mean, it really is just one of those places where old school politics still is strong, and I think we see that happening in some of the smaller mayoral races and some of the bigger mayoral races, and I think it's going to continue to be something that's important up and down the ticket in Mississippi. Race matters in Mississippi.
Yes, sad commentary. Now, a state where it appeared race was breaking down, and really did, even though it didn't turn out for the Democrats as a win. But then Obama did actually worse than George Bush in 2004, so it was a very vexing state. But you worked in that race, that Senate race, in, I guess it was 2006, the one that Harold Ford ended up winning the nomination. Tennessee, what's going on with Tennessee, with it showing so much progress, but then in the presidential race kind of regressing?
I think that you see this. I think one of the things that you see in terms of a wave of movement from Democratic and Republican donors in the South, you see some kind of redemption. I think, look, that's a perfect example that we have here from the Jackson mayoral race. The voters in Jackson wanted to say sorry to former Mayor Harvey Johnson, put him back in. I think you have the same kinds of things happening where Democrats will come out big time and do some amazing things and then get a little nervous when it comes time for showtime. How many times in the history of Mississippi and Tennessee and in Florida have you seen Democrats come out in a big way in a primary and then kind of abandon the candidate in the general? I think one challenge that we have in the southern part of the country that we may not have in other places is these voters have to remain engaged. They're just not like voters in the Northeast. They're just not paying attention all the time. They don't always see how politics directly affects their lives. And candidates who win in these states are candidates who are able to tap in to those moral, kitchen table issues that matter to these different kind of Democrats, as I like to call them. And be able to connect, stay in connection, raise the dollars, and run campaigns that start at the ground and make their way up to TV.
Yeah. Tim, any questions on Mississippi or Tennessee?
I did have one on Mississippi. When you were down there, did you hear any rumblings that Haley Barbour was gearing up to run for president?
I think these are the kind of things that we were hearing back in 07 for the 08 presidential, and I think as long as good Governor Haley Barbour continues to be the kind of powerhouse that he is in being able to have support and have kind of a national stage to stand on, you're going to hear rumors about him running for president. And will Haley Barbour ever run for president? I don't know. I think that he could. I think I don't know if he could win. I don't know if the rest of the country is ready for Haley. But the great state of Mississippi loves him, and he's quite a character, and has done some really amazing things. And look, he is proud to wave the Mississippi flag, his American flag, and that Republican flag. And you just never know with good old Haley Barbour.
Okay. Now, another quick question about Tennessee. Even though the state seems to vote red in a lot of races, Phil Bredesen actually got 69% of the vote in his last race. Mm-hmm. Why was Phil Bredesen so popular up there?
I don't know if you've ever met Phil Bredesen. He is the kind of guy that makes you feel like he loves you. He really is just a great politician, a great leader, and someone who has strong roots throughout the state of Mississippi. He's a household name. He's done some good work there for the state, and people just love him. I think that there's a comfort level, and I think that, you know, in the South, like I say, people are willing to look past Democrat or Republican. They want to know if you're a Christian. They want to know what kind of human being you are. Are you a good father? You know, are you going to create more jobs in their community? Are you going to make sure that small businesses can survive? I think in the South, and I think it's kind of spreading here as we get deeper into this economic recession, people care more about the food on their table than they do about what party you are. And I think Phil Bredesen is good work for the people of Tennessee. They appreciate that, and I think they're going to continue to support him unless he makes some kind of monumental mistake. They just love their vote.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Yes, well, I guess, Afa, since we have you on here, we're going to use our last little bit of time to talk about a controversy that I saw for the first time online this week. And I was actually searching on the Internet. I think it was Blog for Democracy. And a Google ad had said not Robin Hood. And then it attacked NGP quickly in the ad. So I click on it, and they've built this whole website saying that NGP, Nathaniel Perlman's company, is not a pure Democratic company, which, you know, I remember when I first got into politics, Aristotle was one of the big players, and their market share seems to have diminished over the past, say, decade. And then NGP has become, I guess it's the firm I end up seeing do most of the database fundraising software. I don't know the actual numbers if that's a bigger percentage. But it seems like Aristotle's made this attack very personal because it actually uses Nathaniel Perlman's name on this website, not Robin Hood. Afa, what's your thoughts on this controversy?
I want to first of all say I'm biased on this issue. Look, I've been using NGP for the last 7 years. I think they're a great company. Whenever you can call anybody who's providing a service for you and they'll answer the phone and give you help, I think you're having kind of an amazing day in America. Customer service is dead, and NGP is one of the few companies where you can still call and talk to people like Sam Osborne, talk to people like Krista, and be able to get someone on the phone who can guide you through a problem that you're having with their product. They have great customer service, and I think Aristotle, in the past, over the last 10 to 15 years, we really kind of cornered the market on being able to provide lists for you, to be able to help you organize some of your field organization, your volunteers. And they did have some fundraising software. I think, you know, with NGP Online, NGP Mobile, and kind of the continuously advancing world of NGP, I think they are really providing the premier software in terms of being able to kind of organize who your donors are, what your activities are with them. They have some great online, web blasting capabilities. You can blast out to thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people if you want to. NGP is really providing a great service, especially for fundraisers. So I really think some of the attacks, I mean, as an NGP customer, I actually got a flyer in the mail from Aristotle, like you say, Dave, that was launching some personal attacks and claiming that NGP was working for Republican candidates as well. At the end of the day, I haven't seen any proof of any of these accusations yet. I believe that this would be pretty easy to prove, and I'm kind of looking at Aristotle to tell us if this is happening. As a Democratic fundraiser, I don't want to make sure that no Republicans have my list. I'd like to have some of their lists, but I don't want them to have any of my list. That's why I know how helpful they would be. I don't know that hardcore Democrats are giving to Republicans, so it's even a little bit more bizarre of a claim. But let me just kind of sum it up here by saying, Dave, I'd like to see some proof of this, and I think making a personal attack on another company, I mean, it's happening in the corporate world like this, I think is a very, very risky move for Aristotle. And my message to them is, Aristotle, if you have some dirt on NGP, get it up on TV or get us some facts. Stop picking on the guys over at NGP unless you have some real facts, because all you're doing is hurting your own credibility at this point.
Yeah, it seemed like it was very much business dealings, not any political dealings, if you will. Last word on this, as far as, you know, voter list, I think it's not NGP hurting them. It's the DNC and the tools that have been built there so you can do, voter searches so well now online through the DNC, which if a party wants to do something and that cuts out a business vendor, well, that's just the party's job. I mean, you know, and I make money off of political consulting too, but if the party goes out and does something and goes around me, well, that's their job, and I can't have any hard feelings about that. Well,
I appreciate that. I definitely want to give a shout out to Van and to Governor Howard Dean for getting Democracy for America together and getting the 50-state strategy in order through the DNC. And there's going to be a training, Dave. I want to let you and your listeners and let Tim know, too. There's going to be a training hosted by Democracy for America, DFA.com or .org, coming up here in Newark, New Jersey this weekend. They have a bunch of trainings for people who want to learn more about how to run races and how to be better candidates. So I just want to make sure that you guys know about that.
Yes, Tim and I are both fans of the movie Street Fight. Cory Booker up there, the new mayor. I guess the old mayor now. It just seemed like the new mayor watched the film. But, Appa, great having you on. Feel free to come back anytime. We'll probably call on you when we do some more Florida stuff because we just scratched the surface on the statewide races. Hadn't even gotten to the congressionals, but that's how an hour flies by.
I really have enjoyed being on with you and with you, Tim, and I hope that I was able to share some information that was helpful. I definitely think what you're doing, Dave, is great. The show is great, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah, anytime again. Well, Tim, we'll come back next week. We'll welcome Catherine back to the States, and also we'll be able to discuss the Alabama governor's race. We didn't get time tonight, but they've had some new candidates. And also we'll be able to discuss in detail the question, what is Roy Barnes going to do? Because all indications are we'll know by the time we take the air next week.
Right. See you then.
See you then.
All right.